If I have been successful throughout these talks, then I've managed to create in you not only understanding, but maybe even a sense of admiration, or perhaps nostalgia, for the medieval way of viewing the world, for its beauty and order, for what I have called its upward pull of moral gravity, for its sense of vitality and happy energy, for the way in which the spiritual penetrated and flowed through the natural. But there remains, perhaps, one last huge obstacle to appreciation. Here's how Lewis himself put that objection at the end of his discarded image. "I have made no serious effort to hide the fact that the old model delights me as I believe it delighted our ancestors. Few constructions of the imagination seem to me to have combined splendor, sobriety, and coherence in the same degree. It's possible that some readers have long been itching to remind me that it had a serious defect. It was not true." End quote. How then is it possible to get anything out of a model, an understanding of life and the cosmos, if it's not true? Lewis responds to the objection in a way which betrays the influence of his friend, Owen Barfield. Quote, "I agree, it was not true. But I would like to end by saying that this charge can no longer have exactly the same sort of weight for us that it would have had in the 19th century. We then claimed, as we still claim, to know much more about the real universe than the medievals did. But the meaning of the words know and truth in this context has begun to undergo a certain change." End quote. In other words, Lewis here is suggesting something similar to what Thomas Kuhn suggested just 1 year later in his 1963, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. That is, that all scientific models are just that, models. Scientific pictures, which can explain many things and can answer many questions, but which break down when new questions outside of their parameters are posed to them. Lewis returns to the example of a map with contour lines. Quote, "We should be like the man coming to know about a foreign country without visiting it. He learns about the mountains from carefully studying the contour lines on a map. But his knowledge is not a knowledge of contour lines. The real knowledge is achieved when these enable him to say, that would be an easy ascent, or this is a dangerous precipice, or these woods and waters must make a pleasant valley. And going beyond the contour lines to such conclusions, he is, if he knows how to read a map, getting nearer to the reality." End quote. In other words, the contour lines in the map are misleading if taken literally. This, he continues, is the perspective that has begun to emerge even with respect to scientific pictures within his own lifetime. Lewis continues, quote, "And this, if I understand the situation, is just what has now happened as regards the physical sciences. The mathematics are now the nearest to the reality we can get. Anything imaginable, anything that can be manipulated by ordinary conceptions, far from being a further truth to which mathematics were the avenue, is a mere analogy, a concession to our weakness. Without a parable, modern physics speaks not to the multitudes. Even among themselves, when they attempt to verbalize their findings, the scientists begin to speak of this as making models. It's from them that I've borrowed the word. But these models are not like model ships, small-scale replicas of the reality. Sometimes they illustrate this or that aspect by an analogy. Sometimes they do not illustrate, but merely suggest, like the sayings of the mystics." End quote. In this way, Lewis thought that our age, which believes in the curvature of space and quantum physics, was strikingly similar to the Middle Ages, which said things like, God is a circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. Both succeed in suggesting. Each does so by offering what is, on the level of our ordinary thinking, nonsense. As he continues to contemplate what a model is, Lewis goes on to point out that every model is based on some facts. But at the same time, many facts are looked for and discovered because men and women in that age had a psychological predisposition to seek for them. Lewis gives evolution as an example. A whole century before Darwin put forward his naturalistic observations, poets and musicians and philosophers had already developed an evolutionary mindset, a delight in the idea of a humankind that would continue to make progress without end. In turn, this psychological model brought with it a kind of interpretive framework which sifted through those facts that were considered highly relevant, and those facts were just plain facts. Lewis summed this up. Quote, I hope no one will think that I'm recommending a return to the medieval model. I'm only suggesting considerations that may induce us to regard all models in the right way, respecting each and idolizing none. No model is a catalog of ultimate realities, and none is a mere fantasy. Each is a serious attempt to get in all the phenomena known at a given period, and each succeeds in getting in a great many. But also, no less surely, each reflects the prevalent psychology of an age almost as much as it reflects the state of that age's knowledge. End quote. If Lewis is right that there's always something of a gap between the model and ultimate reality, then a comparison of models could help us see that our best efforts to know and order and understand are, to a certain extent, limited. Ultimate reality is higher and holier, more subtle and more fugitive than we commonly assume. And so, by checking our model against the medieval model, we could be made aware that there are facts and realities to which our most up-to-date model simply doesn't wish to even begin to try to explain. That's the more modest version of the argument of why we should be interested in the medieval cosmos. But there's a bolder version, too. The very gap between model and reality allows Lewis elsewhere to indulge in some wild speculation. Indeed, Lewis toys with the idea that nature herself, such as we know her, might now be just the rough draft of a different version which will be fully revealed in the future. And if that were not bold enough, Lewis hints and suggests that we might find hints of this future version of nature in the myths and ideas of the pre-modern world. Toward the end of his book, Miracles, for example, in the chapter called Miracles of the New Creation, Lewis suggests that the resurrection, from a certain point of view, was not just another miracle, but rather the first of a new type of miracle. So many other miracles were just short-circuiting of natural processes. For example, when Christ turned water into wine, he was just doing quickly what nature does every season. Christ turning water into wine was a speedier way of performing the annual biological miracle. And the same could be said for healing. Christ healing the sick was, if you will, a more dramatic way of bringing health to an ailing body, but not qualitatively different experience than when I find myself healing from a wound or recovering from an illness. But the resurrection was the first miracle of the New Age, says Lewis. That is, the beginning of the great reversal. Christ's resurrection, Lewis insists, is a wholly new chapter in the world, an opening of a door that had been previously locked. Whereas moderns tend to think of the resurrection as important, because if it happened, then we can know that God's power intervened and thus helps prove the divinity of Christ. But Lewis argues forcefully that this misses the greatest part of the miracle. It's not just some proof to win an argument, but the first great act of drawing all of creation up to a new level of dignity. Moreover, it was the first act in refashioning space and time itself, as well as the relationship between mind and matter. This leads Lewis now to toss out some bold speculations, which make us see that the wild fantasy in his space stories and Narnian tales were not mere fantasy. For instance, Lewis wonders if in the new creation, our minds will be able to control matter around them, just as now our minds control our bodies. If such a thing were ever to happen, then we would be the beneficiaries of something akin to magic, except without the lust for power. When put that way, you begin to realize that for Lewis, the medieval model, despite some of its factual inaccuracies, had something deeply true at its core, a longing for the obliteration of the distinction between the spiritual realm and the material. Or to state it positively, a desire for a world in which God showed himself forth in the visible world, a kind of corollary of the incarnation in which our own minds begin to increasingly incarnate themselves in the world around us. Thus, Lewis was nostalgic, if I may, for the future. The old model was not wrong, strictly speaking, but a kind of deep human subconscious desire for a world which in some sense we're meant to occupy, but not yet. Nostalgia might have been the chief sentiment of Lewis and his friends, the Inklings, throughout their lives. They repeatedly confessed to experiencing it, especially when reading ancient text. But what they always tried to hint at, and this is where some of Tolkien and Lewis's more vindictive critics missed the point, was that the nostalgia they felt was not just for a past age, but for, as Tolkien so enigmatically put it, a remoteness even older than antiquity. Fairy stories, Tolkien said, quote, are now old, and antiquity has an appeal in itself. And yet always the chief flavor of these tales is the memory, the distance and a great abyss of time, not measurable even by two toys in Ziara. They open a door on other time, and if we pass through, though only for a moment, we stand outside our own time, outside time itself, maybe." End quote. Lewis wrote about this supersaturated experience of antiquity, too, in a quotation I provided in an earlier lecture about how in reading once he experienced, quote, "almost like heartbreak itself, the memory of joy itself, the knowledge that I had once had what I had now lacked for years, that I was returning at last from exile in desert lands to my own country," end quote. But that desire for this distant country merely uses the literature of the past as a medium. It's not the object of nostalgia itself. In other words, our nostalgia, viewed rightly, metamorphosizes into hope. In Miracles, Lewis quite bluntly says, we suffer from a lack of hope in our age. Our deluded conception of heaven is a connection to, quote, "the fact that the specifically Christian virtue of hope has in our time grown so languid," end quote. Whereas, quote, "our fathers peering into the future saw gleams of gold," end quote. When we think about the beliefs of the old world, say how Roland could not break his sword because it had become enchanted with holiness, or how Saint Benedict caused those clay vessels that carried poison within them to crack when he blessed them, we're entertained, but feel a little uneasy. The bodily and the spiritual don't go together well for us. And similarly, Lewis says, quote, "let us confess that probably every Christian now alive finds a difficulty in reconciling the two things he has been told about heaven, that it is a life in Christ, a vision of God, a ceaseless adoration, and that it is, on the other hand, a bodily life. When we seem nearest to the vision of God in this life, the body seems almost an irrelevance," end quote. But Lewis insists that this sublimation of the bodily, this marriage of the material and the spiritual, is what is to come. Quote, "it's not an accident that simple-minded people in the archaic age should blend the ideas of God and heaven and the blue sky. It is a fact, not a fiction, that light and life-giving heat do come from the sky to earth. The analogy of the sky's role to begetting and of the earth's role to bearing is sound. The huge dome of the sky is of all things sensuously perceived the most like infinity. And when God made space and worlds that move in space, and clothed our world with air, and gave us such eyes and such imaginations as we have, he knew what the sky would mean to us," end quote. In other words, it's no accident that the physical world invoked spiritual responses from archaic man. It was designed to elicit those sentiments programmed within it. Our nostalgia, then, can be transformed into hope. Yes, we have to own the modernity of our sentiments, our own exile from the past and from the enchanted cosmos. We can't falsify our emotions, pretending we see and feel as those in an older age would have felt. Still, Lewis, the great lover of myth, desperately wanted to acknowledge that primitive man had got hold of some deep truth. Our nostalgia must be turned toward the future. And if we do, quote, "a curious consequence will follow," says Lewis. The archaic type of thought, which could not clearly distinguish between spiritual heaven from the sky, is from our point of view a confused type of thought. But it also resembles and anticipates a type of thought which will one day be true. That archaic sort of thinking will become simply the correct sort when nature and spirit are fully harmonized. End quote. In the grand historical scheme, then, this estrangement, passing through the era after the Great Divide, is a paradoxical gift. By being forced to wake up to the fact that the old model was not fully correct, we are deprived of the consolation of resting in the merely material. But such exile from the past turns out to be a gift. In The Weight of Glory, for example, Lewis at first describes our modern situation when we have an experience of surpassing beauty. Quote, "for a few minutes, we have had the illusion of belonging to that world. Now we wake to find that it is no such thing. We have been mere spectators. Beauty has smiled, but not to welcome us. Her face was turned in our direction, but not to see us. But this experience of alienation comes as an extraordinary stimulus to hope. Quote, apparently then our lifelong nostalgia, our longing to be reunited with something in the universe from which we now feel cut off, to be on the inside of some door which we have always seen from the outside, is no mere neurotic fantasy, but the truest index of our real situation. In one way, of course, God has given us the morning star already. You can go and enjoy the gift of many fine mornings if you get up early enough. What more, you may ask, do we want? Ah, but we want so much more. The poets and the mythologies know all about it. We do not want merely to see beauty. We want something else which can hardly be put into words. To be united with the beauty we see, to bathe in it, to become part of it. That is why we have peopled air and earth and water with gods and goddesses and nymphs and elves. That is why the poets tell us such lovely falsehoods. End quote. In our age of exile, we don't even have the option to simply rest in an enchanted landscape. And this helps reveal to us that our deepest desire is to possess that enchanting beauty and to hold it within. Thus, the sentiments of nostalgia we get from reading the past are not necessarily misplaced, provided that we understand that they are merely symptoms of a greater longing for something which has not yet come. I'd like to conclude with a few words from Lewis's friend, Tolkien. Like Lewis, he was a great reader, so sensitive to old books. And then at one particular point, Tolkien recalls how every good fairy tale has an intensely happy ending, one that can, quote, give to child or man that hears it a catch of the breath, a beat and a lifting of the heart, near to or indeed accompanied by tears, end quote. But in the best fairy tales, the happy ending is so unexpected, never to be counted on to recur, that the experience could be described as a good catastrophe, or in Tolkien's funny word, a eucatastrophe, providing us, quote, a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world, poignant as grief, end quote. Tolkien concludes his famous essay by reminding us that this is exactly our situation. Quote, it is not difficult to imagine the peculiar excitement and joy that one would feel if any specially beautiful fairy story were found to be primarily true, its narrative to be history. This joy would have exactly the same quality, if not the same degree, as the joy which the turn in a fairy story gives. Such joy has the very taste of primary truth. It looks forward or backward, the direction in this regard is unimportant, to the great eucatastrophe. Art has been verified. End quote. The experience of nostalgia is a feeling of beauty's remoteness, but only because it's so far in the future, or if you like, rooted deep down things. It is hope. And the great thing about true hope, this nostalgia for the future, is that it has none of the irritability, fear, and discouragement that flavors many of the words of those who describe the demise of Christendom in our day. We were denied the garden, and then we were exiled from the enchanted cosmos. Now we must own our modernity. But by doing so, we engage in an extraordinary ascesis of the senses. We must move beyond and look beyond.